Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, February 27, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society Practice Group Teleform. Today, we're going to be discussing Shelby County versus Holder, the Supreme Court case argued this morning that concerns Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. We're going to hear opening remarks from our experts, followed by some back and forth between our experts, and followed by questions from the audience. We're pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. Hans von Spakovsky is a Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and manager of its Civil Justice Reform Initiative, where, among other things, he researches and writes about election law, including campaign finance, voter fraud, voter ID, registration, and equipment issues. He also serves on the board. He also served on the board of advisors of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. Abigail Thernstrom is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, the vice chairman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. She is a member of the board of advisors of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission and an accomplished author of several books. We're going to hear some background on the case from Hans von Spakovsky, and then Abigail Thernstrom will weigh in, and they'll have a little discussion between themselves. And then, as I said, we will get to questions from the audience. So please be giving some thoughts to your questions in advance. And with that, Hans von Spakovsky, can you give us your opening remarks?
Can I say something first, Dean? I am not a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. I am an adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. I left Manhattan Institute about 5 years ago, so Manhattan Institute goes crazy when people are looking for me there, and I'm not there.
Okay, well, so, thank you for that important correction.
Thanks.
You bet. Hans.
Thanks, Dean. Welcome, everyone, to the Heritage Call. Well, they had oral arguments this morning at the Supreme Court in a case called Shelby County versus Holder. The time actually allotted for it was an hour, but it went almost 20 minutes over because of questioning by the judges. Shelby County is in Alabama, and they filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Voting Rights Act, of course, was passed in 1965. Its main provision was Section 2, which is a permanent nationwide ban on racial discrimination in voting. Congress also passed what they termed at that time an emergency temporary provision, that is Section 5. It was originally only supposed to last for 5 years. The point of Section 5 was that at the time, Congress did not believe that Section 2 would be sufficient because they believed that jurisdictions would try to evade successfully obtained court decrees under Section 2 by simply changing their patterns of discrimination and taking other steps to discriminate. So Section 5 was set up such that those jurisdictions that are covered would not be able to put into effect a change in their voting laws unless they got pre-approval from the federal government, either by making an administrative submission to the U.S. Department of Justice or by going to a three-judge court in the District of Columbia and getting a court there to approve it. Because the main symptom of racial discrimination in the voting process in the South was the huge racial disparity between blacks registering and voting and whites registering and voting, which was almost more than a 50% differential in many places, Congress set up a triggering formula for being covered under Section 5 that was based on, one, having a device or test in place in 1965, such as a literacy test that was intended to prevent people from registering and voting, and having registration or turnout below 50% in the 1964 election. When the law was renewed for in 1970, they added the 1968 election. The next time they renewed it, they added the 1972 election. The fourth time Section 5 was renewed was in 2006 when it was renewed for another 25 years. But One of the key points in that renewal in 2006, and this is part of Shelby County's challenge, is that Congress did not update the triggering formula. So that means that the 9 states that are covered in whole and the 7 parts of 7 other states that are covered today are based on registration and turnout data that is more than 40 years old. And that is the heart of Shelby County's challenge. What they say is that the dire circumstances, the persistent widespread discrimination that justified Section 5 in 1965 is not in existence today in the South. And that if you take into account modern registration and turnout rates, neither Shelby County nor Alabama nor any of the other states that are covered would still be under Section 5, because the disparity between black and white registration and turnout has virtually disappeared in the covered states. In fact, in some states, black registration turnout is actually higher than whites. And in fact, the registration rates of blacks in the covered states is actually better than in the rest of the country that is not covered under Section 5. So that was the key issue under discussion today before the Supreme Court. And now I'm going to go over to Ms. Thernstrom, who was also at the court to hear the arguments.
Thank you very much, Hans. And good to be sharing a microphone with you. You have, I just want to kind of add a little bit to what you just said. You've said this case is about Section 5. In my view, and this needs a little bit of an explanation, my view, this case really is about Section 4, which is the formula that determines which jurisdictions are covered by Section 5, which must submit all proposed changes in their method of voting to either the D.C. District Court or the Department of Justice. And I think, and we'll get into this in the kind of discussion of the oral argument, but I think it is Section 4 that is really in jeopardy at this point. But if Section 4 is struck down, Section 5 goes with it, since 4 determines the Section 5 coverage, which jurisdictions are so-called covered. I disagree with you a little bit when you said the main provision in 1965 when the statute was passed was Section 2. Section 2 has turned out to be a very, very important provision, and it's permanent, and it has many advantages over Section 5, like the burden of proof. From my perspective, many advantages, like the burden of proof is on plaintiffs rather than on defendant jurisdictions to prove they're innocent, which is the case in Section 5. But in 1965, Section 2 was simply a preamble to the Act, which reiterated the promise of the 15th Amendment, and it's permanent. And those who today are saying, oh, blacks are going to be disfranchised again, well, number one, Section 2 is permanent. The 15th Amendment is permanent. Obviously, the 14th Amendment, you know, litigation can be brought on the basis of the two constitutional amendments or Section 2. And the complaint is that Section 2 is too hard. Well, it's kind of it takes the form, suits have to take the form of normal litigation where the burden is on the plaintiffs to prove their case. But in 1965, in fact, Section 5 was hardly talked about in the congressional hearings in 1964. And Section 2 really wasn't thought of as an important means of future litigation at that point. I also would like to just underscore the point about the trigger for coverage, including low turnout and a literacy test. What we're talking about here, because the South was famous for them, is fraudulent literacy tests. That is, black, not white, whites were never asked these questions, but blacks who wanted to register to vote were asked absurd questions or given a piece of paper with in Chinese lettering and said, read it, or ask questions like how many bubbles are in a soap bar, or whatever, questions that couldn't be answered. And even black professors at Tuskegee were not allowed to register and vote because they hadn't passed the literacy test. And in terms of the turnout and registration figures, that's black and white, not simply black, below 50% as part of the trigger. That's because they picked that number because it perfectly targeted the states they already knew were engaged in egregious disfranchisement of their black residents. So it was altogether a beautifully designed statute in 1965. It quickly became quite altered. But in 1965, those elements of the trigger were absolutely on target. And again, I don't regard Section 2 as important in that at that time. And Section 5, nobody even noticed Section 5 in the hearings leading up to the passage of the Act. Anyway, those were just a few comments I had on the introduction.
All right. Should we cover now what happened in the oral arguments today?
Sure. Well, I've read some of the mainstream media take on it from this morning, and the general line is Section 4, that is, which determines Section 5 coverage, is in deep trouble. And I agree with that on the basis of the oral argument this morning. But the other half of that statement should be, look, if Section 4 is struck down, Section 5 is dead as well, because if Section 4 is struck down, then the formula for Section 5 coverage is gone. And so while it's accurate to make the usual statement, this is all about Section 5, I think, in fact, it was about Section 4, and five of the justices were very skeptical about whether the coverage formula in Section 4 was still accurate. And indeed, I think it was Sotomayor who said right out the bat, well, Alabama, which in Shelby County is Alabama, Alabama certainly needs to be covered because it hasn't changed at all. And certainly the question of racial change is at the very heart of this case. How much has the South changed? And there is a very clear division on the court about this. I think that the only unpredictable thing that happened this morning was that Kennedy, who is regarded as a swing vote, can't predict him, and so forth on these race-related cases, Kennedy seemed to me very skeptical about the ongoing validity of the coverage formula. So with that, I turn it over to Hans.
Well, in fact, I agree with Ms. Thernstrom, and I have to say that the whole issue about the formula being completely out of date and not reflecting current conditions was starkly illustrated when the Chief Justice asked the Solicitor General, Donald Verrilli, two questions which Verrilli was unable to answer. Chief Justice Roberts asked Verrilli if he knew which state has the worst disparity between black and white registration and turnout today, which, of course, was a key issue in coverage when Section 5 was passed. Verrilli didn't know what the answer was, and the Chief Justice gave it to him. It's Massachusetts, which is not one of the states covered by Section 5. The Chief Justice then followed it up by asking Verrilli if he knew which state was the best in terms of not having such a disparity. Again, Verrilli didn't know that the answer was Mississippi, a state that's covered by Section 5. I mean, that's pretty clear evidence that, as I said, Section 5 doesn't reflect actual conditions around the country. The other thing that I thought was very interesting was that Justice Sotomayor was the first justice out of the gate when Shelby County's lawyer stood up and started arguing and asking some very sharp questions. But the general tenor of her questions was that Alabama, as Abby has said, you know, is just as bad today as it was before. You know, the problem with that claim is it's just simply not true. In the past 12 years, the Justice Department has only objected to one voting change submitted for review from any jurisdiction in Alabama, and it hasn't objected to a statewide submission from Alabama in almost 20 years. That's not evidence of widespread and persistent discrimination. The Chief Justice also asked Varelli, well, how many submissions did the Justice Department get from covered jurisdictions in 2005, which was the year before Congress renewed it? Well, there were 3,700. And then the Chief Justice said, well, how many objections were there? Well, there was only one, which is, again, not evidence of a continuing pattern of discrimination. That's a very important issue because when the Supreme Court upheld Section 5 in 1966 in the Katzenbach case, which is a very seminal case on Section 5, it specifically said that this was an extraordinary intrusion into state sovereignty, unprecedented in our history. It was only justified by the dire and unique circumstances and because of the official systematic, widespread discrimination in the covered jurisdiction. I mean, there just isn't any evidence that that's occurring today.
Well, absolutely. And the comparing registration and turnout rates in covered and non-covered jurisdictions, they're often higher in the covered jurisdictions than in the non-covered jurisdictions. I mean, the racial transformation of the South is a question that runs through this case. And for, I can't remember who it was, but I think it was Sotomayor at the beginning who said, it was Kagan who said things had not adequately changed. No black statewide elected officials. Lots of Section 2 suits in the covered jurisdictions, and so forth. Well, to begin with, you ask anybody on any southern street, any southern town, southern county, whatever, black or white. Ask anybody. Do you think things have changed in the South since 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was passed? And if they're old enough to, you know, be able to answer the question, they'd laugh at you. I mean, there's been an absolute revolution in the status of blacks in the South. And for the court to be, you know, wondering about that, arguing about that, it's ludicrous. In terms of no black statewide elected officials, well, yeah, because most of the black legislators are in the state legislatures, and they come from racially gerrymandered, safe black districts. Well, those legislators have not been running campaigns and do not have the experience to run campaigns that create biracial coalitions, are centrist in their message, and centrist is where, you know, the American public is, and the South, whites in the South, are generally quite conservative. So they're running campaigns that don't appeal to white voters. And guess what? They don't even try to run on a statewide level, because they're not going to get elected. They haven't the skills to get elected on a statewide basis.
Yeah, although we should mention, and this did not come out in the oral arguments today, but this was extensively discussed in the dissenting opinion filed by Judge Williams in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals decision on Shelby County, and that is that the covered jurisdictions have far more black elected officials proportional to the population than non-covered jurisdictions. In fact, the top five states with black elected officials are covered jurisdictions. The worst states in terms of not electing black officials are all states that are not covered under Section 5, including, by the way, Illinois, Barack Obama's home state, and Delaware, Vice President Biden's home state.
No, it's a very important point because if you look at the five states of the Deep South that were the center of white supremacist attitudes and practices, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina, they had no black elected officials in 1965 except from the few historically black towns, and they have greater success in winning public office. They've had greater success in recent years than have the non-covered jurisdictions, as Hans has just said. Look, I want to go back to one other thing that Hans said a few minutes ago about polling places. I think you mentioned polling places, didn't you, Hans?
Well, there was a great deal of discussion about that at the oral arguments this morning.
Right, and somebody, Hans, you'll probably remember, and I don't, somebody made the point, one of the justices made the point, well, more submissions are go to the Justice Department involving the polling place having been moved than any other.
I think that was Borelli.
My husband, who's sitting right here, says he thinks it was Borelli, but Hans, you may remember.
I think it was. I believe he's correct. It was the Solicitor General.
It was the Solicitor General. Okay, so the big issue in terms of submissions of proposed changes to the Justice Department, which has the power to object to changes from these covered jurisdictions. The big issue is polling places. The polling place is moved across the street, and that is a Section 5 potential or actual violation, actual in the view of the Justice Department. I mean, really, if we're down to polling places and the, you know, being moved from one side of the street to another as the main issue before the Justice
and so
Department.
Blacks can't possibly find them.
And with the allegation that blacks can't possibly find the new polling place, even though I would hope the civil rights organizations and the towns or whatever the jurisdiction is would be on the phone, but especially the activist groups would be on the phone to all their, and the political parties, obviously, all their potential voters on the phone saying, get out to vote. And when they get on the phone to say, get out to vote, I don't know about people listening in, but in this past November election, I must say I must have gotten 20 calls, are you coming to vote, the day of the election and the day before. Well, when you get on the phone, these activist groups should, of course, be saying, and by the way, do you know where the polling place is? It has been moved. Is that beyond the political capacity of those who organize get out the vote campaigns? That alone says the Voting Rights Act, really, its day in or Section 5, its day has come and gone.
Yeah, something else I think we should mention, just two other points I'd like to make, is that there was actually a great deal of discussion of Section 2 also at the oral argument today, the general questioning being, is Section 2, where the government or private parties have to file a lawsuit and prove discrimination to try to get a remedy, is that a sufficient way of resolving and correcting discrimination problems? And one of the claims, again, that was made, and I believe this was made by Justice Sotomayor, was that there are many more Section 2 lawsuits in covered jurisdictions. I don't think that Shelby County did a good job of refuting that, even though that is easily refuted. Again, the dissenting opinion by Justice Williams in the Court of Appeals case extensively goes through and discusses that and basically says that when you actually break down Section 2 lawsuits by population, there is no disparity between the covered and the not covered jurisdictions. In fact, he points out that of the 10 jurisdictions in the United States with the greatest number of Section 2 lawsuits claiming voting discrimination, only four of them are in covered jurisdictions, and five of the worst uncovered jurisdictions have much worse records than eight of the covered jurisdictions. So using Section 2 to justify Section 5, you know, doesn't really work. I do have to say one of the most interesting exchanges at which clearly excited people in the lawyer's lounge where I was sitting and listening to the audio arguments was when Justice Scalia basically was panning the overwhelming votes that Section 5 received when it was renewed in the House and the Senate in 2006, because he said that it amounted to, and the phrase he used was, a perpetuation of racial entitlement. And he said that there was no members of Congress that would have anything to gain, according to Scalia, in voting against Section 5 because of the political costs of doing so, even if there's no evidence to justify continuing the law. And in fact, he said that he was confident, because of the political costs involved in this, that Section 5 will be renewed in perpetuity by Congress, even though it was just supposed to be a temporary five-year provision.
Well, another point on the Section 2, I mean, what Hans says is absolutely right, of course, but Section 2 suits are often brought by the starting point is the Department of Justice, which got all these lawyers working on electoral discrimination and what's called vote dilution, but lawyers of the Department of Justice calling somebody locally in Shelby County or wherever and saying, how about ginning up a Section 2 suit? Don't you think a Section 2 suit could be brought here? There are the following facts, and maybe it would be a strong case. And joining them, of course, are black elected officials and other activists in the locality who are keeping a, who have a map on their walls, pinpointing the places where they think places they think might be vulnerable to a Section 2 suit. And they're working full-time on finding places to file these cases. So that, it seems to me, is part of the Section 2 story, why, you know, there are Section 2 cases in some places and not in others. On the Scalia's point, overwhelming vote in Congress, which there indeed was in 2006 for renewing Section 5 for another 25 years, and by the way, I think any time the Senate votes 98-0 for something and the House overwhelmingly, not quite unanimously, but overwhelmingly for something, people watching Congress, politically savvy people, ought to be very suspect. I mean, how many other things could you have a unanimous vote on, going to war in Iraq or Afghanistan, or just name your issue? A unanimous vote is suspect in Congress. And what Scalia was saying when he referred to the perpetuation of racial entitlements, he was referring to the unending insistence by the Justice Department that jurisdictions draw what the ACLU once called max black districts, that is, as many safe districts for black candidates as it is possible to draw without totally wasting black votes.
Well, this is Dean Reuter breaking in here. We've got over 100 people, well over 100 people on the phone. I want to try and get to the audience member questions if we can. Is that okay with the two of you?
Sure, happy to do that.
Okay. We'll hear an announcement, an automated announcement in a moment that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So hold on one moment. Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts about the Shelby County case, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to field questions from the audience. Let me get things started here. Was anybody, the government or even maybe from the bench, explicitly or implicitly arguing that it's only because of Section 4, the formula, and Section 5, the preclearance requirements, that those covered jurisdictions are doing so well, and that the statistics that you keep citing about how well those jurisdictions are doing are the result of the law itself?
Oh, sure. That argument has been made by the government and by others, and I certainly don't disagree with that. I mean, Section 5 is a victim of its own success. It's been extremely successful in transforming the political systems of the South. That's why you now have more black elected officials in the covered states than you have anywhere else in the country. But the fact that it has been successful is not a reason that justifies its continued existence because, again, going back what the Supreme Court said when it first upheld it, you know, they said that it was required to combat widespread and persistent discrimination in voting. And when you don't have widespread and persistent discrimination in voting, you cannot justify a law that basically puts state governments and local governments into federal receivership. You know, we have a federal system. That is something that is very, very unusual, and you have to have extraordinary circumstances to justify that, and those circumstances don't apply anymore. And the idea that suddenly all of these jurisdictions who now have lots of black elected officials and lots of black voters are suddenly going to somehow start discriminating again, there's just no evidence to show that that's correct.
Well, it's also it's just totally illogical. But there's another point to be made here. This was a very confused on the part of the justices, it seems to me, Breyer in particular, confused point. I mean, Section 5, it was argued, was a huge success. At the same time, it hadn't accomplished all that was needed. Therefore, we need to keep it in place for another generation. But you can't have it both ways. If indeed there remain huge barriers to black political achievement in the covered jurisdictions, which I very much doubt, by the way, it seems to follow that Section 5 did not achieve its central aim. And if that's the case, one might argue its goals could not be achieved by draconian restraints imposed from Washington, D.C. You know, you can't have it both ways. It achieved. It didn't achieve.
Go ahead.
Somebody was.
I'm sorry. I was. This is Dean Reuter again. I was going to ask a question of Hans and then of both of you. Abby Thernstrom mentioned Kennedy as in the middle of a swing vote on a case like this. For Hans von Spakovsky, do you agree? And then for each of you, did Justice Kennedy say anything at oral argument, ask any questions at oral argument that would indicate an inclination to vote one way or the other here?
He was expected to be a swing vote. I expected him to be a swing vote. I no longer see him that way, but after the oral argument. But Hans, go ahead.
Oh, look, he was asking questions of both sides, but he clearly, you know, was expressing skepticism over the fact that certain state governments are treated completely different from other state governments, and there doesn't seem to be the evidence present that there's a justification for that. Look, he has a lot of experience in voting rights cases. In fact, I believe, Abby, wasn't it Justice Kennedy that wrote the opinion in one of the most infamous Section 5 cases, Miller v. Johnson? This is a case that actually is worth reading because this is a case that shows how abusive the Justice Department can be when it is enforcing Section 5. And the language that is used in that decision and by the three-judge panel is quite something. I mean, they accuse Justice Department lawyers of all kinds of things, including basically lying to the court, their behavior being an embarrassment to the Attorney General. And, you know, Kennedy is the one that was involved in the Supreme Court's decision in that case, which the Justice Department lost and ended up having to pay over $600,000 in attorney's fees and costs to the defendants in that case.
In terms of Kennedy, as I said, that was the conventional wisdom before the oral argument. Kennedy is a swing vote, and who knows how he'll go. I think that, as Hans just suggested, we've got a good sense of how he may go from the oral argument. I would count him as one of five skeptics about the continuing constitutional legitimacy of Sections 4 and 5 at this point, and let us not forget Section 4, because these are, you know, part of a package. So if I had to make a prediction, I made a prediction in a Reuters piece I did some weeks back that Kennedy would not want to have headlines in the mainstream media, Justice Kennedy kills Voting Rights Act, and therefore he would end up being very skittish about joining the conservatives. After this morning, I think, well, I'm not sure anymore. He could be a stand-up guy with the conservatives on this, in this case, and then in other cases, there are a lot of hot cases before the Supreme Court. Let's start with DOMA, for instance. He could, you know, satisfy the conservatives in those cases. So it seems to me it's up for grabs what he will do. But this morning he sounded deeply skeptical.
All right, let's turn now to our audience for questions. It looks like we've got at least three audience members with questions. If you have a question, you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Thank you. From the discussion thus far and knowing little of the background of the case, it sounds as if most of the challenge to Section 4, Section 5 is to, you know, Congress's finding of legislative fact, that is, Congress's determination of the formula or its identification of states that will be covered by the formula. Conservative justices tend to be skeptical of second-guessing Congress on issues of legislative fact. What is you think, if you could state it, the sort of the conservative argument, the constitutional foundation for overturning these provisions?
Well, it was very interesting. There was a great deal of discussion today about reverse engineering. That kept coming up, and the question being whether in 2006, when they renewed this, they kind of reverse engineered it to make sure those states that are covered stayed covered, even though there isn't real evidence that they are still discriminatory, and certainly any more discriminatory than non-covered states. The basic argument, I think, and this was touched on by Scalia, is that yes, you know, the Supreme Court gives due consideration to Congress when it is holding hearings and making findings of legislative fact, but the evidence that they have presented in the record, much of it is anecdotal, much of it is not accurate, as the dissenting judge points out, and because Congress really exercised a power at the outer limits of the 15th Amendment and its congressional power, the issue is, did they provide sufficient evidence to justify exercising that power? And if they didn't, well, then Section 5 should be overturned.
It's a very, very good question, and I think you're perfectly right in your description of the conservatives' general nervousness about not about being skeptical about congressional findings. But I think, and I mean, the problem here is that on the liberal side of the court, the argument was that the 2006 congressional findings, or the findings in 2005 that led to the 2006 renewal of Section 5 for another 25 years, which, you know, I mean, another 25 years of this stuff, but anyway, that the evidence in 2005 was absolutely overwhelming. Thousands of pages of congressional testimony, mainly from the civil rights groups, showing egregious continuing electoral discrimination. And indeed, the House Judiciary Committee report says, well, the discrimination today may be more subtle than it was in 65. It literally says this, more subtle in 65, but the effect, the results are just the same in terms of disfranchisement of blacks. Now, I mean, obviously, it's a ridiculous statement, a woeful ignorance. I mean, one feels like saying to those who put so much stock in those 2006 congressional findings, thousands of pages of anecdotes, do you know any American history? Do you have any sense of what life was like for blacks in the Jim Crow South? And I think the answer is no. If you can think, take seriously those findings as showing that disfranchisement was basically, this still today is basically the same as it was in 65. So the liberals are arguing that the 06 evidence was overwhelming. I would say that evidence really, it was shockingly weak.
This is Dean Reuter again. Let me give you a programming update. Tomorrow, we're going to have yet another Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum. Our call is going to focus on the American Express versus Italian Colors restaurant case, argued today also, and it'll feature Mr. Tom Hunger, who attended the oral argument today. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. on this same number. And then Friday, March 1st at 1 p.m., we'll highlight a report on terrorism events in the United States. Al-Qaeda in America is the name of that report. And for an updated schedule of upcoming calls, please check in at the Federalist Society website. And with that, let's go to our next caller.
Good afternoon. It sounds like, Abby, you were about to make a point about the majority-minority districts and the impact that this decision might have on those if it is true that the court is going to strike down Section 4 and with it Section 5. A lot of people see these majority-minority districts as sort of the root of all evil in terms of the congressional gerrymandering that sort of gives us our modern-day politics in the Congress. Wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, I've been in a rant about those majority-minority districts, the districts drawn to be safe for the election of minority candidates. I've been in a rant since my first book. I've written two books on the Voting Rights Act. My first book came out in 1987, was called Whose Votes Count. And at the time, people, and I wrote, you know, a couple of op-eds on the subject and made the point that Republicans loved those districts because those districts bleach surrounding districts, make them more white and make them fertile ground for Republican candidates. But the basic point about them is one that the Chief Justice made in 2009. He said that all this divvying up, this sorting of Americans by race is, I can't remember the adjective he used, but basically is appalling. And I agree. It's appalling, and I don't see an end to it unless Shelby County comes out the way I'd like it to. There would certainly be an end to it. But these majority-minority districts have carry a lot of costs, and one of them is that the elected legislators who run in them end up running campaigns that are far to the left of most Americans. They, as I mentioned before, with respect to the statewide elections, they put a ceiling on black office holding and Hispanic office holding. And they don't integrate American politics. So, you know, if those who like them would get a little smarter and enforce them would get a little smarter about what we want in the future, the promise that the Voting Rights Act made of racially integrated politics, they might have second thoughts. And indeed, some blacks in the civil rights community, but also John Lewis in Congress, have raised questions about whether these are so good for black constituents, because they're not.
All right, we've got a little more than 10 minutes to go and a couple questions pending at this point. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll take these in turn.
Good afternoon. This is Benny White in Tucson, Arizona. I have a question. It sounds in Section 4. Arizona was originally a covered jurisdiction because of discrimination against a language minority group, not a racial group, and that had to do with our Hispanic population. The argument at the time was that we did not have enough Hispanics registered or voting, but we've always had to deal with the problem of determining which Hispanics are citizens and which are not citizens. But under Section 4, one of the arguments that has been made in the renewal is that the Justice Department dispatches observers to federal elections in the states, and just the dispatching of observers is justification for continuing covered jurisdiction status. That always seems strange to me that it requires no violation or no complaints, but simply that the Justice Department dispatches their army of lawyers, which they have. Was that addressed at all in oral arguments today?
No, it wasn't addressed at all, and I have to say at the outset in answering you that I think the whole notion of a language minority group that is the equivalent of blacks who experience true disfranchisement in the Jim Crow South is ridiculous, and I've thought it was ridiculous since 1975 when they put in the provision about language minority groups and made an equation between a jurisdiction that did not provide bilingual ballots, made an equation between such jurisdictions and a jurisdiction in Mississippi in 1964, say, that simply wouldn't let blacks register to vote. No way, no how, they weren't going to be allowed to register to vote. And it's a ludicrous equation. The absence of bilingual ballots, well, you know, the activist groups can hand out ballots that are translated, they can get the word out on the radio, but in any case, it's just not equivalent to stopping blacks, highly educated blacks, from voting in the Jim Crow South. So I think the coverage, that whole minority group protection, I've thought from the beginning, was unjustified.
I should say, and I could talk about this actually from personal experience, while it wasn't mentioned today, the Federal Observer data was used to justify the renewal in 2006, and you know, I keep going back to the dissenting opinion in the Court of Appeals. Judge Williams there basically shreds the accuracy and value of that Federal Observer data. And here's what I can say. I actually used to work in the Civil Rights Division, and one of my jobs was reviewing the request to send out federal observers to covered jurisdictions. And I can tell you that for the vast length of time that the Justice Department has been enforcing Section 5, getting federal observers, the department just rubber stamps that. You know, if they get a call from a jurisdiction, from a voter saying, well, I think there's things going on here, really without any evidence that there's anything really happening, the department will send investigators there. And if you want to know how valid that is, you know, compare the number of observers sent out by the Justice Department, compare that then to the number of lawsuits actually filed in those jurisdictions. In other words, they send observers, the observers actually find something real going on, and the department then files suits. In the last 5 years, you can check the website of the Obama administration. You'll find the last 5 years, they have filed one Section 2 lawsuit in the entire country.
I love that figure.
Thank you.
Hans, you can make this clearer than I can, but, I mean, the Justice Department sends the word out to localities and to racially, you know, activist groups call us. Be free to call us. Feel free to call us. Do it if you think we can play any role here. And so there is an ongoing invitation to complain to the Justice Department. Would you disagree with that, Kahn?
No, not at all. And okay. at the least request, the Justice Department will send observers, but they almost inevitably don't end up finding any real discrimination that needs to be investigated and sued over.
That's your tax dollars going to work.
All right. At this point, we have one question pending. Then our telephone lines will be open. Looks like we've got two questions now. So if you have a question, you want to add yourself to the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi. Forgive my relative ignorance of the details of this law, but what strikes me a little bit in this whole conversation is why the court would be analyzing the further need for this law at all. It seems to me like Section 5 of the 14th Amendment gives Congress the power to enact the Voting Rights Act, the Section 5 and 4 and 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And so why are we having a policy discussion in the Supreme Court as to whether it's needed anymore to enforce the 14th Amendment? Am I missing something here?
14th
well, Amendment. Hans and Abby, before you weigh in on this, let me let you know that we've got two additional questions after this question and about 6 minutes left, so go right ahead.
Well, I'll just say, and I'm sure Abby will also weigh in on this, that in fact, the Voting Rights Act, particularly Section 5, was passed to enforce the 15th Amendment. If you look at the 15th Amendment closely, you'll see that it prohibits intentional discrimination. We haven't talked about the legal standard under Section 5. The legal standard under Section 5 doesn't just prevent intentional discrimination. It has an effects test. So a legislature can pass a law with no purpose whatsoever to discriminate. It's a perfectly neutral law in that respect. But if it somehow affects voters on a disparate basis, well, then it violates Section 5. And like I said, that's not intentional discrimination as Section 5 prevents. The 15th Amendment.
Well, let me weigh in here. Look, in 1965, the Section 5 prohibits changes that are discriminatory in purpose or effect. But in 1965, effect was a very good sign of racist intent. That was no longer true 10 years later. It is certainly not true today. So an effects test was once legitimate, in my view. It is certainly not today.
All right, two more questions. Let's move on to our next caller. Go ahead, caller. If you've muted your telephone, you need to unmute your phone.
I'm sorry. It just occurs to me, I'm listening to the comments on covered versus uncovered areas, that it's making an argument for expanding to currently uncovered areas.
For nationwide coverage, that came up today, but the fact is the Justice Department cannot handle submissions nationwide, nor can the D.C. District Court. It was talked about in 2006. It was dead on arrival as an idea, as it should be. So at this point, it seems to me the question is not expanding the scope of Section 5, but reducing the reach of Section 4 and 5 and getting this statute back or forcing it to take a more sensible shape in the face of massive racial change across the nation, but especially in the South since 1965.
Hans, did you want to speak to this issue?
No, I think Abby covered it.
Okay, looks like our final question.
Hi, this is Will Trackman out in Denver, Colorado. I was curious, by what standard are we asking, did Congress exceed their authority under, I guess, Section 2 of the 15th Amendment? Is it the congruence and proportionality standard from the City of Bernie cases, or is it the necessary and proper standard that a lot of liberals argue we should be looking to? I remember in Tennessee v. Lane, Justice Scalia had a dissent saying, for racial discrimination, I'll do necessary and proper, but for everything else, I'm not doing congruence and proportionality, and I have a stricter standard even then. So I'm curious what the legal standard is for a power grab, basically, on Congress's part.
Well, I think that's somewhat unclear, although, in fact, the congruence and proportionality issue came up today. And I believe, in fact, Justice Alito asked specifically a question of the Solicitor General over that issue. So there was discussion of whether the current remedy of Section 5 is proportional and congruent to what is going on in the states.
Right, but of course there's no agreement on what is going on in the states, with those on the left in the court saying, oh, massive electoral discrimination still. I mean, that's going to be, I suspect, a major thread running through whatever decision they come out with.
Yeah, there was a great deal of discussion of supposedly second-generation discrimination, because the first generation, which were, you know, literacy tests, directly keeping people from registering and voting, even Congress admitted those were no longer present. But while they kept talking about second generation barriers, there really wasn't a discussion of what they considered to be a second generation barrier.
Well, didn't everybody assume they were talking about vote dilution?
I think they were, although I was actually surprised that the term voter ID never came up, since that's the complaint that's constantly made about that, even though, for example, Georgia's law was pre-cleared as not being discriminatory under Section 5.
Yeah, nice point on the voter ID. Or the long lines that presumably disfranchise people? Or the felon disfranchisement, alleged disfranchisement? Lots of things didn't come up that would come up if Congress were to rewrite the Voting Rights Act to make it look like many voting rights advocates want it to look like.
And a final question here. Are we anticipating a decision on the final day of the term, or any thoughts on that?
Have you got a crystal ball sitting on your desk?
I do not, but it's been suggested that Justice Kennedy, in particular, might be weighing, you know, his role in multiple cases that could all come out on the final day of the term or the final week of the term. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, sure, it's a possibility, and I expect, as I said before, that Justice Kennedy is going to be trying to protect himself a bit, and if it's a bunch of cases down at the same time, maybe he can come across as, in the view of the left in this country, oh, reasonable on this case, unreasonable on another case, and kind of so that his tombstone won't look as if he has done anything egregious.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Hans von Spakovsky and Abigail Thernstrom for attending the oral argument today, and of course for reporting to our audience. This has been a fascinating discussion. And for our audience, I invite you to join us for our next Teleform conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. When we'll be again looking at a Supreme Court case, American Express versus Italian Colors Restaurant. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.